When you were growing up, the music you play was not the music of what was on the radio. There were crooners, there were big bands, there were Broadway musicals and stuff. So how did you find your way to the music that you turned out to love? Cowboy music, traditional music. Where was your the first way you discovered that?
I remember coming home from school and going right to the radio and turning it on. And every afternoon, must have been, a few minutes after 3 o'clock. And this is exactly what I heard every day. That'll stick with old Strawberry when he takes that dive. That was Montana Slim singing Strawberry Road. And now we have, and then go on. I come right up the tail end of Montana Slim singing Strawberry Roan every day. That'll say, like hardly a man is now alive that'll stick with old Strawberry when he takes that high dive.
Well, and the other thing, I go ahead.
Working on my mind as a would-be bronc rider. And I wasn't that interested in music, but I was interested in bronc riding. I'd been to the rodeo in Madison Square Garden when I was 9 and 10 and 11 and 12. That was in 1940. Gene Autry was the singing star. Back in the saddle again. Out where a friend is a friend. Where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly Jimson
Jimson
weed.
weed.
Back in the saddle again.
I'm sure there were other early on other people that influenced you. I know there was a rodeo clown, as I understand, that played some role in this.
Oh, yeah, Bramer Rogers. Well, I ran away from home when I was about 14 and a half. No, 15 and a half, 15 and a half. With two other weirdos I knew from school, Don Finkel and Carl Margulies, two poets that I knew from the Cherry Lawn School in Darien, Connecticut. I was later evicted from that school for trying to convert their Shetland pony into a bareback bronc. The school was owned by a fabulous woman, Swedish lady, and her name was Dr. Christina Stahl von Holstein Bogoslowski. And all of the teachers, we only called them by their first name: Duncan, Bob, Ralph. Didn't even know their last names. It was a very progressive school. They just weren't ready for me.
Probably still aren't. Now, so then you ran, you say you ran away and you found, where'd you hook up with the rodeo in
Yeah, that was in Washington, D.C. at the U-Line Arena was the J.E. Ranch Rodeo. Colonel Jim Eskew was the head man that was the boss of that outfit. And I got a job working as a groom. They were going to pay me $2 a day, and they named me Poncho after one of their beloved old rodeo clowns who used to drink white wine and let the bulls throw him up in the air.
Wow.
I later saw a picture postcard photograph of a bull looking up at the sky, and there he was in the sky, Pancho Villa, clown. And the bull was waiting for him to come down so he could catch him on his horns and throw him up in the air again.
Wow.
White wine.
And so Brammer Rogers introduced you to some music that I think you still play.
Well, he played the five-string banjo and guitar, mostly banjo, I think. And he lived in Florida. He was originally from East Texas. I was only on that outfit for about 3 months. My parents sent out circulars, you know, with my photograph, Missing Persons Bureau. And one day, Colonel Jim called me over to the main house and showed me the photograph. It was an early picture of myself sitting in a little boat. And he said, is this your picture, Poncho? And I said, yes, that's my picture, Colonel Jim. Well, he said, why didn't you tell me you was a runaway? If I'd have known you was a runaway, I never would have hired you. I said, well, maybe that's why I didn't tell you.
Now, and shortly after that, I mean, you weren't that much older. 1951, you met Woody Guthrie. And the brief time that he was not in the hospital in that period of time, you were with the Guthries, and
when I was with him was before he ever went in the hospital. But then
right.
He'd been showing the signs of his illness coming on strong, of Huntington's disease, which eventually took him out.
But you probably are the great link between Woody and people today, because you really kept his music alive. I mean, you weren't the only one, but you had a particularly skilled way of doing Woody's music.
Well, I thought I was just imitating his style of singing. I was always fascinated by sound effects, and I used to like to do imitations of steam engines. I could do Franklin Roosevelt speeches.
I want to read some that Arlo posted on his Rising Sun Records page a couple days ago. On August 1st, Ramblin' Jack will celebrate his 94th birthday. Naturally, Marty and I already sent him a homemade greeting via email. Better early than too late. There's not too many people I would make a comment about, let alone a birthday greeting. After all, we have them once a year. But Jack is more than important. He's mythic. Not that it would matter much to him, but it does to people like me. I can't remember a time in my life when Ramblin' Jack wasn't around. He'd always been there. Somewhere I probably learned more about performing and guitar playing from Jack than any other single person, just absorbing, never a student in the regular sense. And it's not just me. Talk to Bob Dylan, he took what he could, the rest was history. From the old days in the village, at the Gaslight, through years and decades, Jack has seen most of it all and reminded himself. That's saying something up through more recently with Bob Weir and friends. Jack means something. He's a treasure, much to his chagrin. I want to acknowledge him as best I can. I can't put in word what resides inside me except to say happy birthday. Now, I've always seen the great affection between you and Arlo. I mean, I have been able to see that. But I was also thinking how many of your peers who I got to know had said to me in private, you know, there's nobody better than Jack. I mean, Pete Seeger said that to me. Dan Ronk said that to me. Eric Von Schmidt said, you know, I'd walk over hot coals to see Jack play. He goes, and there aren't many in that group. Good friends with Johnny Cash and Kris Kristofferson. John Prine has always said you were a great force in his life and his writing and his playing music. You've outlasted just about all of them. It's just about you and Willie left. And at your age, your buddy Willie, do you think that really it was the life you chose which has helped your longevity? The being on the road, being aware of things, being into sailing, being into music, being into traveling.
Yes.
So one of the things that I always wanted to talk to you about in an interview, because everybody will ask you about this. I've heard, been in the room when people have asked you these questions, is you once said to me, I love playing music, but just as important was the fact that it let me see the world and travel. That music was the vehicle that allowed me to go all the places I've been. I've never heard anybody really say that before.
But I did say that, huh?
Yes, you did say that in Burlington, Vermont. I remember exactly
Oh,
where.
I'll say it again then. I think that's true. I still think it's one of the best things about my existence.
You've always had a deep love for sailing and sailing ships. As Rich Hilsinger said, Jack loves to sniff out a good ship, or good boat. And I was remembering that it was, we were playing a show in Burlington, Vermont, and it was a beautiful fall night. It wasn't mud season, it was a beautiful fall night. And you saw a guy drawing a picture of some rigging on a napkin. And I remember you paused and you looked at it and you said to him, that looks like the Alyssa, which you had worked on rigging a tall ship. And he said, yeah. And then you pointed out that he had, and I don't know the term, but he had some block wired, rigged backwards or something. And you guys got talking. And I was just sitting there watching. And he said, want to go sailing the next day? You want to go sailing tomorrow? And we had to be in Albany that evening, I guess. And you said, the first rule of Ramblin' and Jackin' is always going sailing. And we sailed in his 34-foot sloop out on Lake Champlain.
Really?
And he said that he had never gotten it to 18 knots, but that said it could get there. And he'd only gotten it to 16. And by God, you got it on the rail and got it to 18 knots. And I thought to myself, I will sail anywhere in any sea with Jack. That was spectacular.
Boy, I wish I could remember that.
Well,
Fantastic.
it was funny because you only could go out for a couple hours.
Wonderful. I have no recollection of having done that, but we must have had a great time.
We did. Now, the other thing, the reason I brought that up is very early on when you were young, you wanted to know about sailing ships. What spurred you to do that?
Well, there were three men. First of all, Alan Blomqvist lived down the street from me, a Swedish boy. His parents were from Sweden and they spoke with a heavy Swedish accent. And his father was the superintendent of 128 Linden. Most of the New York City building superintendents were ex-mariners who knew how to work with pipe because all the buildings in New York are steam heated. And he was a former sailor and he had sailed in lumber schooners on the coast. And Alan was showing me some pictures in a book one day about this Norwegian couple, Erling Tams and his wife, were sailing around the world in a boat from Larvik, Norway. And the pictures of the boat, and they had a baby halfway around the world. And when they got to New Zealand, they were shipwrecked. That was the end of that journey. And I was fascinated by the book and the pictures. And Alan's father walked into the room just then as I was admiring this book. And I had never met the man before, Mr. Blomqvist. And he says to me, "Can you name the mast in a sieve and masted schooner?" I didn't know what to make of it. I'd never heard of such a thing. And I asked him to please repeat the question. And he said it again. Good, you made the best, 7 to 7, best in school. And I said, no, I don't think so. What is it? And he told me, 4 main, mizzen, yeager, pusher, driver, spanker. I was hooked. And I've been hooked ever since. 4 main, mizzen, jigger, pusher, driver, spanker. There was only one 7 master ever built. She was the Thomas W. Lawson, steel hull, built in a shipyard in Quincy, Mass, around 1919, I believe. And she carried case oil for the Anglo-American Oil Company. She made one trip across the Atlantic and ran aground on a rock while the captain was having an argument with the tugboat captain about the price of a tow. That was the end of her trip. She sunk.
Now, you also own and fabricated the only square rigger dinghy that you, the dinghy you put the square sail on it.
That was a pain
down Arlo's Pond at about 100 miles an hour.
I have the mast from that boat.
That's great. Now, do you get out in the bay much?
Yeah, I'm out on Tomales Bay, not enough, but it's very, very windy out here. There are lots of days that you don't want to go sailing.
You were an East Coast guy originally. You've been in Northern California a long time now. It's clearly a place that you feel, where you feel at home. I know that one of the things that you like about that is that it's beautiful and it's calm and it's not really bustling and crowded. But I know you're still playing some. What's it, how hard is it some days to say, oh, do I really want to go to McCabe's and play tonight, or do I want to stay here?
Yeah, well, McCabe's is about 500 miles from here.
Yeah.
In L.A. or La La Land.
Yeah.
But we have we did have some cattle ranches all around this area here, but it's a disappearing thing. In fact, my neighbor friend and I, Terry, went out for coffee this morning and took a look at the waves on the north side of near Point Reyes Light and the beach and the ocean and the waves and the cows. But there's hardly any cows left because the ranchers are being evicted from their land by the anti-agriculture people.
I wanted to ask you this question. You've won 2 Grammys, been nominated 4 times. You've won the National Medal of the Arts. You're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. When you think about that, and you, that's no small deal. That's a big deal to have accomplished all those things. When you were traveling around Europe in the 50s with Daryl Adams, riding around on a Vespa, did you ever think all those things would happen?
No, I didn't think about it. I wasn't capable of imagining such things, but still, it was. I was very impressed when it did happen, and it was a lot of fun. And, my daughter asked me, I have one Grammy up on the where we used to have a wood-burning stove. And she asked me, where was the second Grammy? And I said, I think it's in the same place they both were originally before you asked me that question. Made me dig them out and put them up and show them off. But I don't get to polish them every day.
Well, speaking of your daughter, Ayana, she made the movie The Ballad of Ramblin' Jack, which was shown at Sundance. And I got to, at the time, you had the motorhome at my house, and we were able to take some trips, and Ayana came with us, and then we took the car down to see Pete and Toshi Seeger. One of the things that I, every once in a while, when I look at the film, I say to myself, I don't think someone that didn't have the affection Ayana has for you could have made that movie, because it's an honest movie. It doesn't blow smoke up anybody's skirts, and I really like the way she incorporated the people who wanted to talk to you. You know, the people she interviewed, that show we did in Westport, Connecticut. We're actually, I'm wearing that shirt today, that with Van Ronk and Paul Jeremiah and Eric Von Schmidt, Harvey Brooks, Gordy
Did Eric
Titko.
draw that cartoon?
I think Eric drew the cartoon. It's a show Chance put on, so it might have been, but I think Eric drew
Chance might have
the
drawn it.
cartoon. And I thought to myself, I'm with Jack, so they're calling me a legend of folk music. I'm almost feel like I'm almost in over my head. I'm on stage with you, Van Ronk, Harvey Brooks, who played with Miles Davis in The Doors, among, you know, so many other people, and Gordy Titcomb, who I've liked since he was in Arlo's band a million years ago, and Eric, and I'm sitting there saying to myself, this could be the greatest night of my life, right? And Chance is beaming, and he's happy, and he's playing, and it seems that you've always had the ability where you'll be playing, and the most remarkable people show up. I remember Vaughn Meter showing up when we played at Raoul's in Portland, and
Right.
we had a lot of fun with him. And
I met him a couple of times.
yeah,
Very nice man.
and then you know, when we drove to the set of Ironweed, and we're driving in the motorhome, I go, "Look, look at that old drunk stumbling across the way." And you go, "Bruce, that's not a drunk. That's Tom Waits. He's in the movie." And I got to spend part of the night in the boxcar with him singing Utah Phillips songs. And then we got to go to Jack Nicholson's trailer and meet Hector Babenco. You've met a lot of incredibly important people in the music business and film and theater and entertainment. Mick Jagger and Eric Clapton have talked about how you were an influence on them. If you had to name one person that you thought was had the most influence on you, would it be anybody other than Woody?
This man lifted me up by my collar and the seat of my pants when I had just only met him moments earlier. We were going to be doing a TV talk show in Toronto, and I've been on the show once before, and incidentally, one of the important, interesting people who couldn't talk on the show was a Maine lobster brought in by its owner or its fan. What do you call it? A lobster owner. A woman had this lobster, and it was trained. They could pet the lobster in a certain manner that would he would go to sleep.
Ed Muskie, the old senator, used to be able to do that. He would hypnotize a lobster.
Fantastic. And then they would wake the lobster up with a sudden shock of a snap of the fingers, perhaps, and it would jump about 3 feet in the air. I was in the makeup chair being made up. And the compere of the show was a Canadian guy, had a Polish name. Anyway, he said, "Welcome back to Canada, Jack. Good to have you in the show. Would you do us a favor, Jack?" I said, "Oh, thank you. Yeah, sure, anything. What can I do?" He said, "We have Schwarzenegger on the show. Would you take your shirt off?" I didn't know who that was. I said, "Sure." Moments later, I go in the green room and I met Mr. Schwarzenegger. He's built like a brick house. I noticed right away. I said, "You work out?" "Yeah, we got talking about gymnasium stuff." Well, a friend of mine had presented me with a little gift to smoke, and I had stuck it in my shirt pocket, but it fell out of the pocket. And now down on my hands and knees, crawling around, not far from Mr. Schwarzenegger's wife, who's sitting on a chair, and I'm looking for the lost joint. And suddenly, I feel myself hoisted into the air by my collar and my belt. And I hear this accented speech. What are you doing? I said, I'm looking for something. He said, not under my wife's skirt. His wife, I was looking for my, you know, the joint on the floor, somewhere under that chair. He got it all straightened out. He ended up giving me his phone number.
All right. As a
matter of fact, Nicholson did too, and those phone numbers were both in my wallet, and the next time I looked for them, they weren't there.
And I made a copy of Nicholson's phone number and put it in my wallet, and I don't know where it went, because he said, don't write anything on it as to who this could be. Don't even write Jack on it. I said, okay. So I said to myself, what am I going to say on the back? And so I just wrote Ironweed on the back, because I remembered that we were there at the movie set.
Nicholson just said Jack 4-5 something. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, anything that went in the motorhome was likely to disappear. I don't know.
Well, you know, the person that got those phone numbers was not a thief. They're a fan.
One of the things I think that is remarkable about a certain level of musician, it's a person that can go on stage in a big arena or a big theater all by themselves and get the audience in the palm of their hand. I remember we played a gig in Long Island, and we drove up and it looked like a strip mall, but it was a really nice place inside, and they had nice people, and Van Ronk was on the bill. And I played, and Dave played, and you were on, and there was a break between you and Dave, and people were drinking. They were starting to get rowdy and loud and stuff. And the guy introduced you and people got quiet. And about 5 minutes later, you had him eating out of the palm of your hand. And Van Ronk turned to me and he goes, God damn, Jack, that's an unbelievable feat. I said, what is this? He's got him in the palm of his hand and they're drinking. I didn't want to laugh out loud, so I'm like, but it was remarkable. And where do you think your ability to use your incredible storytelling and your music to
recording in progress
get an audience is so has worked so well?
I got that way from hanging out with guys like you. Bob, you know, Bob slept on Dave's couch for 6 months when he first arrived in New York.
Yeah.
Dave's wife, Terry.
Terry Thall, yeah.
Terry Thall was Bob's first manager before Albert.
Yeah, and I think just Paul Jeremiah's manager for a while, too.
Paul Jeremiah, good guy.
One of the best, man.
He's still living, but he's living in some kind of a catering facility.
Yeah, but Jim Mercek sees him every once in a while. And
good old Jim.
Yeah, Jimmy's the best. He actually wrote the theme music for the podcast that we do, that Rich got him to do. Yeah, he can play piano. He still can't play guitar like he could, and boy, nobody else could play it any better. But he can play and do some stuff.
Good with cameras too.
Oh yeah, and didn't he tell you one day he was running down the end of the street with his spear gun to get dinner? Maybe that was Dave. Somebody he when he was living in Rhode Island, he said, I gotta be going out of the house with his snorkel and his bathing suit and his flippers, and he was going down to get some dinner because he didn't like the fish that he had. I mean, there are only a few originals, and Paul is definitely one of them.
I remember he was getting ready for a car trip where he was going to be playing some gigs all across the country with his old car. I think it was a Dodge Dart or something.
It was.
And the floor had some rust in it. I helped him oil the floor. We oiled the rusty floor and baked up like a 1 month supply of baked potatoes.
Which he would put on the manifold when he drove.
And he had to do his laundry. And we went to say farewell to a neighbor, a beloved neighbor, who had been a fighter pilot in World War II, lived down near the water, one of those mansions.
You know what I remember about that Dodge Dart? When he got it, he and I were playing a place in New London, Connecticut, and Buddy Cage was there too. Paul says, I got a new car. Yeah, I got to show it to you. It's right out front. And I thought, Paul Jeremiah bought a new car? Wow, this is really cool. And he goes out and he says, here she is. And I go, well, Paul, that's a 15-year-old Dodge Dart. And he said, yeah, because they just don't make new cars like that. So I changed the oil. He says, Jack, help me oil the thing. We did this, we did that, blah, blah, blah. He says, I got this whole thing of baked potatoes, and I'm on my way to Texas to see somebody and then play somewhere all the way out to California.
Yeah, I remember that tour. I didn't go on it with him, but I was there in spirit.
Yeah.
So, too. Jack, what was my friend Bruce like on the road?
Bruce, I thought Bruce was going to run for governor of Connecticut for a while. Because you were so good with a pitcher of beer and a 12-string guitar. You could, like, take the world.
It was fun.
You had that crowd in the palm of your hand.
Well, you know, I think what was really lucky was a lot of that time we were getting booked in the right places. I remember driving down to Piermont one time, and we're driving along, and there was this lady on the side of the street tugging on this dog and dragging this dog, and I was driving and you were in the passenger seat. You rolled down the window and you said, how much for that dog? And the woman says, what are you, a crazy man? What's going on? You're some kind of a crazy man? And you said, no, really, how much for that dog? Finally, she went running off saying she was going to call the police or something. Rich and I got the chance, with along with this show's producer, to go down and see the actor Jeff Daniels at who was in The Purple Rose of Cairo, which was filmed right there, right, you know, in Piermont. And I told him that story, and he just roared. He said, that's really funny. And then turned out he's a hell of a guitar player and a really good singer and songwriter. And he said, you were there with whom? And I said, Ramblin' Jack Elliott. And he goes, I wish I'd been on that bill. So I'd love to have been on that bill.
I can't recall. It sounds like that Piermont might be on the Guyland.
Piermont's right across, it's in Nassau, it's right across, not Nassau County, it's in Orange County, it's just south of Nyack, and it's right on the Hudson. I'll think of the name of the place in a minute.
I think I lost a Swiss Army knife there.
Yes.
I got it back a few days later.
The Turning Point, that was the name of the place.
The Turning Point.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah, nice club. I was like
restaurant.
Yeah.
Hudson River.
Right on the river. Yep.
Near the bridge.
Yeah, right near the Tappan Zee Bridge, just south.
Bridge.
Now, speaking of the Hudson, Pete Seeger told me that there were many times when he was first learning to sail that he might have sunk the Clearwater if you hadn't been aboard. Especially coming into Bridgeport Harbor, as I recall.
You know, I spent my entire time on that boat up on the main gaff adjusting the rigging on the peak halyards and throat halyards that lift the sail up. Because one of the crew members on deck that was hanging out with Pete was a Pete worshiper. He had small clutch of admirers, a very large group of admirers, but this was a small clutch of hangers-on that stayed right close to Pete on deck. And I preferred the air up aloft.
Speaking of another Hudson River thing, you and I played a gig with Doc Watson in Tarrytown at the big theater in Tarrytown. And Doc heard your voice, and he was in the dressing in his dressing room, and he went, "I swear to son, that sounds like old Jack Elliott out there." You got to we were talking, and Doc was facing us. We had our back to the door. And Jack Lawrence, who played with Doc, was also facing us. And you said to Doc, "You should hear Bruce. He does a good impression of Pete Seeger." So I was doing my, "Well, if we could just get the boat all lined up," and I was doing that. And Doc was laughing and going, that's righteous. That's righteous, boy. Give me some more." So I'm doing it. And then I look over and I see Jack Lawrence's eyes are like the size of tomato soup cans. I thought, "Oh my God, Pete's standing behind me. What's going to happen?" And I remember I sort of turned around slowly, and you sort of turned around slowly, and it was Tom Chapin that was there instead. It wasn't Pete. But I felt, boy, that could have been a bad thing. Though I think Pete would have thought it was funny. But you guys kept egging me on. "Give me some more of that."
Wow.
Well, I hope we're not tiring you out.
No, this is a real pleasure. This morning I went down and picked up Terry, and we got some coffee. And I didn't get coffee this time. I got some hot chocolate, which was not very good. And we went to look at the waves and say hello to some black bulls on a ranch where they're saying goodbye to all their cattle. And it's kind of sad out there. But we spoke to the bulls and enjoyed the waves for a while. And then we raced back here to meet with you. That's been great.
One of the things that I really wanted to say is, you know, you've had a profound effect on my family. I remember when Ben was only 6, and Ben is 45 now. So I don't know, maybe he was 7. We all had gone to a concert, and we're back at the house. And the next day you were getting ready to leave. And Ben said, "When I go to school, I'm going to tell everybody I met the real Ramblin' Jack Elliott." And you just picked him up and hugged him and said, "I'm going to tell everybody on the road I met the real Ben Pratt." He has never forgotten that.
He's looking good.
Yeah.
You're looking great.
He's doing
You're
well.
All
doing
great.
Yeah, we're all hanging in.
It's fine.
Well, I certainly hope that we'll get out to see you before too long. We've been tied up with projects here at the farm for a couple of years.
I'll have to come and see you guys. Well, I'm still very fond of Maine. I tell everybody out here, Maine is the only Western state east of Missouri.
Love that.
Oh, we got to keep that, Rich. We got to keep that one. Well, yeah, we'd love to see you. And if you were playing anywhere in New England, we'd be there to see you for sure. And you know, you look great. I'm just so happy we got to do this, and maybe we'll get to do it again another time.
Oh, I sure hope we can.